There's so much to remember.
School is so hard.
How do people make it through this?
What did that professor say?
I want to be a nurse. I want to be a good nurse.
Glomerular filtration rate.
Pediatrics. Geriatrics.
But what's going to be
heart rate,
tie
Fowlers, low Fowlers. Some say that nursing school is the hardest thing that they've ever done. I'm Dr. Hobick, and I am a passionate nurse and a passionate nurse educator, and I'm here to help. Join me on Nursing with Dr. Hobick as I review topics and highlights from nursing school and try to help nursing students become confident nurses and provide the safest, best quality patient care that's possible. Hey, and welcome to Nursing with Dr. Hobick. I'm so excited today because we're going to talk about our first pharmacological class of medications. Today, I'm thinking about the nervous system, but not the whole nervous system. Today, I am thinking about part of the nervous system that is called the autonomic nervous system. If you didn't know, our nervous system is split into the central nervous system, which is your brain and your spinal cord, and our peripheral nervous system, which is everything else. The peripheral nervous system is then split further into the somatic nervous system and the autonomic nervous system. I'm going to talk about the autonomic nervous system today. And when you think autonomic, it should sound like automatic. And that's kind of what the autonomic nervous system is. This is a system that kicks in and is in charge of involuntary stuff. It's things that we don't have any control over. The autonomic nervous system functions are regulation of the heart, the respiratory system, the GI tract, bladder, the eyes, the glands, like salivary glands or sweat glands. We can further break down the autonomic nervous system into two branches. We have the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. These act on the same organs but produce opposite effects. We want to have homeostasis. We want to have balance. So medications that affect the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems are either going to stimulate or depress responses. First, we're going to talk about the sympathetic nervous system. It's also called the adrenergic systems. I want us to discuss the word agonist. Agonist, according to dictionary.com, in biochemistry, is a substance which initiates a physiological response when combined with a receptor. Agonist is going to poke the receptor. It's going to bind with the receptor. It's going to cause a response. If we're talking about the sympathetic nervous system, this is sometimes called the fight or flight system, it's going to have the fight or flight response. So an adrenergic agonist is a chemical or a substance that is going to stimulate the sympathetic nervous system. These medications are actually going to mimic the neurotransmitters norepinephrine and epinephrine, which have an action on adrenergic receptors, which are in the heart, the lungs, the GI tract, the urinary bladder, the ciliary eye muscles. It's going to affect all of these. The functions that we see are things that will make sense if we're trying to run from a bear. If I'm going to run from a bear, I want to be able to take in all of the available light. I want my eyes to dilate. I want to be able to breathe in a lot of air and take up as much oxygen as I can. My lungs, they're going to dilate. The airways are going to dilate. My heart is going to start beating faster in order to deliver more oxygen and nutrients and remove waste products as I get ready to have a lot of skeletal muscle movement. The heart rate's going to go up. We want to constrict the blood vessels so that we can increase perfusion, but also increase blood return to the heart so the heart is able to increase cardiac output. At the same time, it's going to say, we don't need to worry about digesting right now. We need to worry about running. We don't need to worry about trying to pee right now. We need to worry about running. We're going to have this opposite effect on the bladder and the GI tract. It's going to relax it. It's going to slow down peristalsis. It's going to relax the bladder. It'll also have some action on the uterus, relaxing that as well. The next thing for us to think about with adrenergic agonists is that they're IV sometimes, and when they are high-risk medications. Adrenergic agonists and antagonists are high-risk medications. We need to be very careful with those. Now, our adrenergic receptors come in two flavors. We have alpha and beta. Alpha is then broken down into alpha 1 and alpha 2. Alpha 1 receptors increase cardiac contractility, meaning it can pump harder, increases vasoconstriction. It'll dilate the pupils. It increases blood pressure because of our vasoconstriction. It's going to increase bladder relaxation. Alpha 2 receptors are a little bit different. We'll talk about those in a little while. They are going to promote vasodilation and decrease blood pressure and also decrease GI motility and tone, meaning we're slowing down peristalsis. Beta receptors are the other kind. These are beta 1 and beta 2. Beta 1 receptors are mostly found in the cardiac tissue. We have one heart and beta 1 go together. These are going to increase cardiac contractility, increase blood pressure, and increase heart rate. Beta 2 receptors are mostly found in the lungs. We have two lungs, beta 2. These are going to decrease GI tone and motility, bronchodilation, because they're mostly found in the lungs. They can also activate the liver, causing it to go into glycogenolysis, which means it's going to increase blood sugar. There is a little bit more to this. We also have dopaminergic receptors, and these are located in the renal, mesenteric, coronary, and cerebral arteries. Stimulation is going to cause vasodilation, which will increase blood flow to those areas. There's another way that medications can be adrenergic by limiting the reuptake of the neurotransmitter. If we're talking about norepinephrine, there are two enzymes that can actually inactivate norepinephrine. These are monoamine oxidase, which is sometimes referred to as MAO. This one's inside the neuron, and then catecholmethyltransferase, which is COMT and is outside the neuron. A medication can actually interfere with that enzymatic action of inactivating the norepinephrine and increase the duration of action of the norepinephrine. Our adrenergics can also be split into catecholamines and non-catecholamines. This distinction has to do with the chemical makeup. Catecholamines are going to produce our sympathetic response. These are epinephrine, norepinephrine, and dopamine. Those are our endogenous catecholamines. And synthetic ones are isoproterenol and dobutamine. Non-catecholamines, these are stimulating adrenergic receptors. These have a longer duration of action than our endogenous and synthetic catecholamines. These are phenylephrine, metoproterenol, and albuterol. Next, we talk about how they work. The classification of adrenergic agonists is direct acting, indirect acting, or mixed acting. Obviously, our epinephrine and norepinephrine, these directly stimulate the sympathetic receptors, the adrenergic receptors. Indirect acting is going to stimulate release of norepinephrine from the nerve. It's not going to actually stimulate the receptors itself, but it is still going to get them stimulated by actually releasing that norepinephrine. We also have mixed acting. So ephedrine and pseudoephedrine, these are mixed acting. They can stimulate the adrenergic receptor sites and stimulate the release of norepinephrine. Because of the actions that we see in these medications, as nurses, we need to assess to make sure that they're safe to give to our patient. We need to look at their vital signs. We need to know what their baseline is. This medication is going to have an effect on the cardiovascular system, on the lungs. If the patient already has a high heart rate, we might want to reconsider giving these medications, or if they have a high blood pressure, making sure that we know our patient's history, medication history, anything that they're taking over the counter. The thing that we're thinking about here with these medications is often decreased tissue perfusion or hypotension. These medications are often given for those sorts of things. As far as interventions that we can do, obviously monitoring those vital signs, and then we should be reporting any tachycardia, palpitations, tremors, dizziness, hypertension. If the patient develops any new dysrhythmias, we need to report those. We also need to very closely monitor the IV site. These medications can infiltrate and they can actually cause cellular damage. Anybody who is hypertensive or diabetic, remember that we can have that stimulation of glycogenolysis, which can cause the blood sugar to go up. If they have a dysrhythmia already or coronary artery disease, this is going to increase the workload on the heart. We want to be careful with those. They also have nasal sprays that have adrenergic properties, that are adrenergic agonists, and we want to caution our patients to only use those for a few days at a time. Otherwise, they can actually cause rebound congestion. I told you earlier that we would address the alpha-2 receptors. Those are our central acting alpha agonists. These two medications that I'm going to bring up, these are the two that I have seen, clonidine and methyldopa. These are selective for alpha-2 adrenergic agonists. They will actually bind to the receptor and stop the release of norepinephrine. They're agonists by binding to the receptor site and causing a response, but they're actually stopping that release of norepinephrine, which means that they're really good at treating blood pressure. There's also medications that are going to block these receptors so that they can't be activated. These are sometimes called antagonists or blockers. We have alpha blockers and we have beta blockers. I've seen far more beta blockers in practice than I've seen alpha blockers. One of the reasons for that is because alpha blockers can cause orthostatic hypotension. This is where your blood pressure drops when you're changing positions from lying, sitting to standing, and it causes you to get dizzy and maybe even pass out. These can also be selective or non-selective. If they're selective alpha, it's usually alpha 1, and then selective beta could be 1 or 2. Remember, one heart, beta 1, two lungs, beta 2. The alpha 1 antagonists are going to block the alpha 1 receptors, which will cause vasodilation. It could cause orthostatic hypotension with reflex tachycardia. It can cause the pupils to constrict. It can reduce the contraction of the bladder. And it's often used to decrease symptoms of benign prostatic hyperplasia by relaxing that muscle. And it can be used for something called Raynaud's disease, which is a condition where they have extreme vasoconstriction that can actually cut off blood supply for a bit. Overall, our beta blockers are going to decrease blood pressure and heart rate. So our beta 1, remember one heart, decrease blood pressure, heart rate. Our beta 2s, because they are found mostly in the lungs, are going to cause bronchoconstriction. Because of that, we need to use them very cautiously in patients who already have a constrictive lung disease. So COPD or asthma, we want to be cautious. Propranolol is one of the first generation beta blockers. It is non-selective, so we would not want to use that with asthma or COPD, or at least use caution. It can actually be used for angina, cardiac dysrhythmias, hypertension, and even heart failure. Some of our most common selective beta blockers, metoprolol and atenolol, these block beta 1 only. So they decrease blood pressure and heart rate, but they have fewer side effects. We might see a slow heart rate, too slow, or low blood pressure, too low, maybe some headache, dizziness, fainting, maybe some fatigue or drowsiness. These are some of the common side effects. There are also a couple of beta blockers that have this intrinsic sympathomimetic activity. They can block or bind to the receptor so well that it's going to prevent a strong agonist from binding to the receptor. The non-selective beta blockers that have this are carvedilol, pinbutilol, and pindolol. There's also a selective one that has ISA. This is acebutolol. On the flip side, we're going to talk about the parasympathetic nervous system. The parasympathetic nervous system is the system that says, let's calm down. Sometimes you'll hear it as rest and digest. It's the opposite of the sympathetic nervous system, which is fight or flight. Here we're talking about the cholinergic system because the neurotransmitter that we're talking about here is acetylcholine. The cholinergic receptors are either nicotinic or muscarinic, meaning that they're stimulated by alkaloids, nicotine or muscarine, respectively. Medications that mimic norepinephrine and acetylcholine will produce responses opposite each other in the same organs. They're opposite in the same places. This is going to be a little bit of a repeat of what we've already talked about for the first 12 minutes. Our cholinergic agonists are going to stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system. They're going to bind to those cholinergic receptors, either muscarinic, which are stimulating smooth muscle and slow heart rate, or nicotinic, which you can kind of put together with neuromuscular in your mind. These receptors are going to be found in the skeletal muscle. Just like with our adrenergic agonists, we have two types of cholinergic agonists, direct acting, that are going to actually interact with the receptors to activate the tissue response, and indirect acting that are going to inhibit the action of cholinesterase, which is the enzyme that will inhibit acetylcholine. Our direct acting parasympathetic stimulants or cholinergic agonists are going to cause a decrease in blood pressure, a decrease in heart rate. We're going to see constriction of the bronchioles, constriction of the pupils. There will be some increase in urinary contraction and an increase in peristalsis. This is directly opposite of what we talked about with our sympathomimetics, our adrenergic agonists, the ones that are stimulating the sympathetic nervous system. A couple of examples of direct-acting cholinergic agents are bethanacol, and it acts on the muscarinic receptor. Usually, it's used to increase urination in the treatment of urinary retention or neurogenic bladder. Metoclopramide hydrochloride is used for gastroparesis or nausea. It's to increase gastric motility. It also increases gastric emptying time. Pilocarpine is also a direct-acting cholinergic agonist, and it's used in the eye to constrict the pupils and open the Schlemm canal, that's a great word, isn't it? Schlem canal, to promote drainage of aqueous humor, which is the fluid inside your eyes. That helps to treat glaucoma by relieving that intraocular pressure inside the eye, promoting meiosis during eye surgery and examinations. Our indirect acting cholinergic agonists are going to interfere with the enzyme cholinesterase, which is what breaks down acetylcholine. Just like earlier with our indirect acting adrenergic agonists, this is going to cause extra acetylcholine to build up or to be available. These come in two varieties. We have reversible and irreversible. The reversible is used to treat a condition called myasthenia gravis, which is a condition of muscle weakness. The effects of the reversible cholinesterase inhibitors usually persist for a few hours, and often, as I said, they're used to increase muscular strength in patients with myasthenia gravis. We have short-acting neostigmine, moderate-acting pyridostigmine, and long-acting ambinonium chloride. Pharmacy students, don't come for me if I said that one wrong. The irreversible cholinesterase inhibitors are going to last a much longer time because they are irreversible. The enzyme cholinesterase actually has to be regenerated before this medication effect is going to diminish, and this can take days to weeks. A lot of times these medications are used to produce that pupillary constriction. We're going to move on to the last group that we're going to talk about today, the cholinergic antagonists. These medications are going to inhibit the action of acetylcholine, usually by blocking the acetylcholine receptor sites. These are usually referred to as cholinergic blockers or cholinergic antagonists. If you were to take these four types of medications and put them in a block, let's say we have on the left-hand side our adrenergic agonists at the top and antagonists at the bottom, and we have cholinergic in the next side on the right, agonists on the top and antagonists on the bottom, the opposing types are going to have very similar actions. For example, anticholinergics and adrenergic agonists are going to produce many of the same responses. Keep that in mind when you're trying to understand these concepts and apply them when you're taking a test or taking care of a patient. The major effects that you're going to see from an anticholinergic medication is a decrease in GI motility. That means that it's going to slow down the GI tract, a decrease in saliva, and dilation of the pupils. The word for that is mydriasis. We can also see an increase in pulse rate. Since they also affect the bladder, we could see a decrease in bladder contraction, which could unfortunately lead to urinary retention. And they can also be used to decrease rigidity and tremors related to neuromuscular excitement. These anticholinergics are going to inhibit the actions of acetylcholine by occupying those receptor sites. They're also going to affect direct and indirect acting cholinergic agonists. One of the anticholinergics that I've seen very commonly is called atropine. Atropine actually was first derived from the belladonna plant. I think that's pretty cool. The plant's name is Atropa belladonna. So that gives you an idea maybe where they came up with the name atropine. This happened way back in 1831. It's a classic anticholinergic. It's a muscarinic antagonist medication. Second anticholinergic that was produced from the belladonna plant is called scopalamine. These two both act on muscarinic receptors, but they have very little effect on the nicotinic receptors unless they're given in really high doses. Atropine is most often given preoperatively to decrease salivary secretions. Atropine can also be given to increase the heart rate when the patient's heart is beating too slowly. We call that bradycardia. It also acts as an antidote for a muscarinic agonist poisoning, like too much bethanacol. Since this is an anticholinergic, you should expect some effects that are similar to what we see with an adrenergic agonist. We're going to have that increase in heart rate, pupil dilation, a decrease in GI motility, maybe some decrease in peristaltic spasms, and a decrease in gastric secretions as well as those salivary secretions. Because this is going to cause pupil dilation, it's going to be contraindicated in patients who have glaucoma. Remember that we were giving the other medications to cause constriction of the pupil to allow that Schlem canal to be able to drain the aqueous humor. I've also used scopalamine quite a bit. Most of the time when I've seen it used, it's for nausea or motion sickness. I also had a patient who had excess salivary secretions that we would use the scopalamine patches for. Scopalamine comes comes in a little round patch that you place behind the ear on the patient. This patch is changed out every 3 days, so 72 hours. The only other thing to remember about that is to ensure that you place it on one side, and then when you change it, you place the new one on the other side. Finally, we have some anticholinergics that are helpful for symptoms of Parkinson's. These are used as anti-Parkinsonism anticholinergics. Benztropine is one of these medications. These are going to help to decrease involuntary movement and tremors and muscle rigidity that we see with Parkinson's. They're going to have the same sort of side effects that we would see in our adrenergic agonists: dry mouth and skin, tachycardia, blurred vision, and urinary retention or constipation. As you can imagine, these medications are going to be contraindicated in myasthenia gravis and also in glaucoma and anybody who has a really fast heart rate, so tachycardia. That's adrenergic agonists and antagonists and cholinergic agonists and antagonists in a nutshell. I thank you for hanging out with me for over 20 minutes for this episode. I appreciate your time. I hope that you enjoy these, and I will see you next time on Nursing with Dr. Hobick. Hey, this is Dr. Hobick. First, I want to say thank you for listening. This podcast is intended for nursing students to help them understand concepts that they're learning in nursing school, and maybe for students who just graduated and want to refresh on concepts, or nurses who just want to listen. Anyway, I do want to thank you for listening, but I also want to say that by listening to this podcast, you agree not to use this podcast as medical advice to treat any medical condition in either yourself or others, including but not limited to patients that you are treating. I want to encourage you to consult with your own physician for any issues you may be having. They will be your best source of information that is accurate and consistent and based on research and evidence. Again, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time on Nursing with Dr. Hobick.